Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks, as always, for joining me as we travel back in time and travel back through some collections of cards, through the various boxes and binders, and maybe even a hard plastic case or two. We're heading back to 1977. A favorite set of mine. I think it's still very underrated in terms of design and some star power and availability. It's still out there if you want it at mostly reasonable prices. We're talking 77 tops. And once again, through your contributions, a few weeks ago, I was able to get a pretty good deal on an unopened 77 tops pack, which we did open up on our YouTube feed yesterday. And if you didn't see it, just go to our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains and scroll down a little bit. Just click on the link and watch it. I won't completely spoil the break just yet. I'll talk about some of the cards that I got in there in just a few minutes. But we're actually not going to focus on the cards from the pack this time around, even though we had some interesting ones. We're going to talk a little bit about the artwork and the expansion teams from 1977. Of course, 77, the first season for the Toronto Blue Jays, as well as the Seattle Mariners, and a big challenge for Topps. How do you take a handful of players, basically about 40 players, and then some pictures of coaches and managers as well, how do you take all these, and in the time span of just about 4 months, create a team set of cards for a team that hasn't even thrown its first pitch? It was a daunting challenge for Topps. It was different from what they had to deal with the Major League expansions of the 1960s. And we will discuss that by taking a look at some of the Blue Jays and Mariners cards that I have from my own personal collection. I don't have a ton of them, but I was able to find four Mariners cards, including the dreaded manager card, but also what's interesting about the manager cards in 1977 is that it featured the entire coaching staff, which I always thought was a very neat approach to the dreaded manager card. And I also have six Blue Jay cards. So instead of going through and discussing the, what is it, 12 cards in the pack, we'll go through and talk about the players featured in the 10 cards I was able to find in my own personal collection. And we'll have a little discussion about those expansion teams, a couple of the players, some really surprising stories about some of these players. And, oh, by the way, we'll also discuss the artwork again, which was brought up by one of our listeners, a great suggestion from listener David Moody, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. First, as we always like to do, like to set the table at the very beginning of the program. Our next show will be 2 weeks from this Friday, so make sure you tune in on April the 28th. That is when our next program will be coming around, and who knows what we'll be talking about. We've been kind of going all over the place the last few weeks, touching up on looking at the current Topps Heritage set and comparing it to the 1970 set, looking at the 92 Upper Deck box that we opened up a couple weeks ago, which was a fun bargain bin, why not purchase. And again, this week, looking at 1977 Topps. So you never know what you're going to get, and want you to tune in. We have our shows every other Friday, every 2 weeks, and it is based on our Audio Boom website. But, of course, you can listen to it via iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, Spotify. It's everywhere. If you have any of those podcast apps or any of the apps that fetch the RSS feeds, however you consume Wax Ecstatic, make sure you continue to do so. And tell a friend, even those that don't collect these days, maybe they still have a box of cards just sitting in a closet somewhere. And, you know, a good friend of yours, maybe the two of you 20, 30 years ago were buying baseball cards left and right. Maybe you've moved on from buying the current products. But if you have somebody that is even not a current collector, but somebody who has some great stories and memories from the past, as you know, we focus primarily on past sets, past cards, past players, and it's always a fun walk down memory lane. So spread the word about Wax Ecstatic. If you are listening on a an app that allows you to rate the program or comment on the program, please do. Give us as many stars. Tell us your honest opinion. That also helps promote internally with these apps. The more positive reviews we get, the more positive feedback, it bumps the program up in the standings a little bit and you know, makes it a little more open for people to find. So we certainly encourage that. And of course, Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, pass it along to friends, as well as the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed is open 24/7 for your commentary. And you could talk about just the industry in general, or even just the sport of baseball. You know, the season up and running now, everybody going, and even, you know, teams have played, what, 10, 12, 15 games now. You've got some fan bases that are ecstatic, some that are absolutely livid and panicking. Folks, it's the middle of April. Calm down. What's the old saying? It's a marathon, not a sprint. Yeah, it's a long season. So don't get a little too high or a little too low about your team's performance right out of the gate. So yeah, you could talk about baseball. You could talk about baseball cards. Talk about any of the sets that we discuss, any of the players we discuss. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can go ahead and throw them up there. We read them all the time and react as well. And also, if you want to keep Wax Ecstatic going, we certainly encourage you to make a cash donation of any amount. It could be as little as just a few dollars, or it could be more than that, whatever suits your fancy. And you can do that cash donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And as always, I remind you that your contributions go right back into the show. These are not contributions that just sit in my bank account. I don't go out on the town and enjoy, you know, expensive wine and escargot. I wouldn't eat that crap anyways, but yeah, you know what I mean. I'm not living off your dollars here. Your money goes back in two ways. One, just maintaining the website, and also the archive via Audioboom. So if you want to listen to any of our 125 plus episodes from the past few years, it's available to you because of the donations in kind. We are able to keep that website up and running and the podcast coming your way. And also it goes to the purchase of packs. This 1977 Topps pack that we are opening, that is all because of you. We had a few donations coming over the past few weeks. We were able to get a good deal on the 77 Topps pack, and voila, we've got a show out of it. We've got some really cool cards out of it. It's all part of a great suggestion from a listener. So it all comes together here. So if you have already donated, thank you very much. We appreciate it. If you haven't donated, again, please think of, even if it's just a few dollars, you know, $5, if you want to put that up there, you can send it to paypal.me/waxecstatic. Other podcasts charge. Other podcasts have advertising. I'm always open if there's a sponsor or an advertiser that wants to, you know, buy some time on the program. We can certainly talk. But as of now, it's a free show. It's sponsor free, but it still takes some money to maintain the show and also pull in some of the cards that we have, that we open, that we share, that we find on the open market. And it helps make the show a lot better. And I will also always dangle that 1989 Bowman Rack Pack as a threat if the donations do dry up and I don't have too many resources to get the types of cards that most collectors want to talk about, then I will open up that 89 Bowman Rack Pack. You have been warned. We will have yet another 89 Bowman show if you're not too careful. All right. As for 77 Tops, this was a great suggestion by David Moody, who sent me an email. In fact, this was not an email. It was a comment in the money donation that he made several weeks ago. And he actually wrote a litany of ideas. And again, David, I thank you, and I will threaten to make you an associate executive producer if you're not careful. But he made a lot of great suggestions with his donation. And one of the suggestions that certainly stuck out to me as a good idea, but also as something that might coincide with opening of 77 Tops, was the idea to talk about the expansion players in the 77 Tops set. Talk about the artwork, or as he calls the god-awful airbrushing. And yeah, 77 was not a banner year for airbrushing in the Tops sets. There would be worse to come, though, as we'll discuss. And he also posed an interesting question. How many of these players actually played for the expansion team? So, like I said, I have 10 cards, and I know that of the 10, a couple of them never played for the team that drafted them in the expansion draft, or perhaps they weren't acquired in the draft itself, but either as a free agent or acquired through a trade. There was another player who was drafted, and then Seattle or Toronto then moved that drafted player for somebody else. So some interesting stories coming from the 10 cards that I pulled from my own personal collection. And we'll also give you a little background on the airbrushing fiasco. It all starts with basically how Topps had their whole photography department set up in the 1970s. The way that it was set up would have been pretty efficient in the 1960s, but as times were changing and as the card set was changing, and it changed a lot throughout the mid-70s, the way that they were handling photography was not quite as efficient as it used to be. And you would see Topps eventually start shifting more of its efforts in photography, specifically when the pictures were taken, locations of the photographs, to help them, you know, make those adjustments and do a little less airbrushing in the 1980s in particular, even though they still airbrushed quite a bit in the 80s. So we'll talk about that, but I first want to address the pack that we did open. Now, I will put out a spoiler here if you haven't watched the video link yet. So just kind of hit that mute button on your podcast player for about 10 seconds here. Did I get an Andre Dawson or a Dale Murphy or Jack Morris rookie card? Nope, didn't happen. But what I did get was right off the bat, Jim Palmer, which is a great card. You got a Hall of Famer there. A birthday twin of mine. We share the same birthday, which is kind of cool. And also an interesting uniform combination, as Palmer was wearing the bright orange Orioles top. And back then they had the white pants. And with the white front hat that they wore in the mid to late 70s. It's a very interesting color combination. And it's also very vibrant because, speaking of photography, the processing of photographs back then, and also some technological upgrades in the Topps factory by the mid to late 70s, really made pictures like this pop. Really made the colors stand out. So the Jim Palmer card, the biggest card that I was able to get out there. And also, you know, some notable names that were in there, but nothing outstanding. There was a Yankees team card. Of course, the Yankees would win the first of two consecutive World Series in 1977. I love the team photos. And it's funny, we talk about, and I know we've kicked this horse into the ground a few times, you know, the dreaded manager card. I like how they incorporated a small insert photo of Billy Martin with the team photo. And, you know, you have Yankees on there, and then it says, you know, manager Billy Martin. And I thought that was a neat way to address the team, to address the manager, and then on the flip side, you've got the team checklist. And I've always thought that that was kind of neat. So, you know, one of the best teams of the 1970s in there. And it also turned out that my pack was pretty much the Orioles special. I had three Orioles cards in there. Not only Jim Palmer, but Doug DeCinces and Paul Blair as well. So always, you know, a fun trip down memory lane. Didn't get that big rookie card. Didn't get that Robin Yount or that George Brett, you know, a second or third year card of a big star there, but was able to just go through the pack and you know, hold these old cards. And that's half the fun of just opening up some vintage wax, is just opening it, seeing it, what is in there. And the story behind the pack itself, like I said, it was paid for by listener donation, so thank you. And basically, you know, it just went on eBay, and you have to be very careful with eBay, as I've mentioned. You have to buy from a reputable dealer. You have to make sure that they've got 100% feedback, make sure that, you know, they've sold lots of items before, take very close looks at the pictures, you know, make sure that You don't have any comments from irate buyers. You've got to, you know, really do your homework, and then you have to be patient as well. It's very easy when you're buying unopened wax to just simply throw out a high price and hope that somebody doesn't match it. So I was able to just sit and wait and wait and wait. And including shipping, I think I got this pack, I want to say like $32, I want to say. And shipping was like $4. So, you know, getting the pack for $28 or $29, something like that, is actually very good for 77 tops. I've seen some 77 tops packs recently going for upwards of $50. And even though the 77 set does not have that megastar rookie like 75 had Yount and Brett in it, you know, you still have some pretty notable names in the 77 set, be it a big rookie or young stars or even veteran players who are still plugging along from the 1960s, i.e. Jim Palmer is a great example. So we were able to find the right price for the right pack from the right type of dealer, and certainly enjoyed opening that up. And again, if you go to Wax and Gum Stains, just scroll down the feed a little bit. You'll see that link from yesterday if you want to take a look at the pack break. Part of the fun of 1977 Tops as well is the artwork of the wrappers. And, you know, this is something that I think people are finally starting to come around to. Topps did some incredible artwork with their packs prior to 1980. You know, in 1980, you had the consistency, basically the exact same pack design from 1980 through 1990. They would just alter the background color from year to year. And then, you know, they started getting a little more creative in the early 90s when they had to, when there was a lot more competition out there. But if you look back from basically the late 50s through 1979, some great artwork on the wrappers. And what really stands out is the artwork from basically the 1970s, where you had a lot of color, a lot of caricatures, if you will, some very 70s style typeface on there as well. It's a graphic artist's dream to look at some of the artwork from the 1970s. And I'm not a graphic artist, but it's still kind of neat. You can look at the artwork from the wrappers, and you definitely, you know, you can close your eyes and you can envision what the 77 Topps wrapper looks like. Likewise, you could do the same thing with like 1973 and 1975 and 78. The only really boring designs were 1974 and 76. And a lot of that had to do with, as we'll discuss here, Topps just trying to find ways to save money. So, you know, the 76 wrappers, in fact, in 76, they reused some extra wrappers from 1974, and the design essentially was the same from 1974, all in the name of saving a few dollars. So, you know, the 77 top set, a pack is always fun to open, and then there's just something neat about that particular artwork from the Topps pack and some of the cards that you find inside. Now, as for the set itself, it's a 660 card set, and it features a lot of, you know, like I said, notable rookie names in there. The biggest would be Andre Dawson. You also have Danny Martinez is in there as well. Dale Murphy, as I mentioned. You have a lot of young career cards for some big stars from the late 70s and early 1980s as well. Some key veteran players. Some interesting subsets, too. In fact, you've got the Turn Back the Clock subset, which was featured in the previous few years' sets. That was very popular. Also, the Big League Brothers, which was interesting. And the first one that comes to my mind is George and Ken Brett. So if there was a pair of brothers playing in Major League Baseball in 1976, Topps went out of their way to find them and include them on a card. So you had the Brett brothers. You also had Phil and Joe Niekro. A lot of interesting little subsets here. Fun cards, too, to throw in to the base set. Now, the design of 77 Topps is one of my favorites because it is a very clean design, very simple, but certainly not boring. As I mentioned, the photography, the quality of the photography improved greatly in the mid to late 70s. You weren't dealing with as many dark or as blurry cards as you saw earlier on in the decade. And you also had a pretty clean design around the photography. And the photography was the star of the card. I'd say probably about 85% of the front of the card is devoted to the picture. You do have a slight white frame around the card, and then a thicker or a deeper white frame at the bottom of the card, which featured the team name in this italicized bold letters. And you had the player's name and position down there as well. And I've always enjoyed just this very simple display by Topps. And this is somewhat similar, not exactly the same, but somewhat similar to what you saw with the 64 Topps set, where if you hold the card back, you know, put it in your arm or put it in your hand and then stretch your arm out and kind of squint a little bit, it looks like the old Polaroid photographs. Remember those when you had the Instamatics and it would spit out your picture there and you'd shake it and you'd, you know, give it a couple minutes to develop? That's kind of what 77 Topps looks like. It looks like a Polaroid picture, which is very emblematic of the times. And as we've said, Topps always trying to do that. So it's not just a simple and clean design, but it's also something that looks like something else from pop culture at the time, which I thought was neat. Now, the backs of 77 Topps cards, I've always enjoyed the backs of 77 Topps because there's a little trick to them that most collectors have never noticed. First of all, you will notice if you flip over a 77 Topps card, green, yes, green was the color for Topps in the 1970s. We've discussed this before, where the dark green ink, which was apparently bought by the palletful and must have been sitting in a warehouse somewhere in Brooklyn for many, many years, Topps utilized dark green in the back of their baseball cards for many, many years. And that was no different here. It's something that they used in 1971, also came back in 1974, 76 as well, 77. You'd see green come back in 79 and 82. Green was everywhere. So that's something you do notice. What you don't notice, though, is with the layout, it appears to be the normal back of a baseball card where you have the player's name, you have his career stats on one side, you have a little cartoon or a little trivia fact on the left side. And it looks like a normal baseball card back, but if you look at the bottom of the card, you will see these little lines, like these little X's. It looks like a fence almost, or a gate. It is actually supposed to be the base or the legs of a billboard. So if you, again, take a 77 Topps card, flip it over on the back, and kind of hold your arm out a little bit, you'll see what I'm talking about. It looks like a horizontal billboard just in a grassy field somewhere, showing off the statistics of this particular player. So even though it's, all right, a little hokey, and even though it's something that doesn't jump out at you, I always thought that was a really creative design element of 77 Topps. You know, somebody was sitting around sometime in 1976 going, all right, well, how are we going to design the back of this card? And they go, hey, Henry, how about we try this? Let's put it on a billboard. So the Topps artist had to create this cartoon billboard that acted as a template for all the information that went on the back of the card. So I thought that was very, very unique, and you didn't see anything like that, certainly before or after. It was a very cool element to that one particular set. Sure, you had faux autographs before, and you had cartoons, and you had some interesting layouts before. And then the Topps cards got very, very stale, very static afterwards, especially in the 80s. It was, you know, Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am. You didn't have a whole lot of creativity to them, just a mixture of colors on the backs of the cards. So 77 Topps was that one set that really stands out. I think the only other set that has perhaps the very unique back, at least from that particular era of cards, was the 78 Topps set, which had the play ball game associated on the back of the card. But, you know, that was kind of a bonus to the card itself. Hey, we can play a game with these cards. Where 77 Topps, it was just this completely creative element of, let's not just present stats and cartoons and personal information about these players. Let's do it in a fashion that makes it look like a billboard. I always thought that was pretty cool. So I've always liked that. I've always liked the 77 top set, as I've described before, for a couple of reasons. One, 1977 was my birth year, so you always have that personal connection to the set from the year that you're born. Even if maybe you didn't always collect it at some point in time, you're always linked to that year. So if you're a serious card collector, chances are you have bought some cards, even if it's just a few singles, you've bought some cards from your birth year simply because it's cool to have something from your birth year. And then the other reason, as you know, growing up, I was a Toronto Blue Jays fan. 77 was the Toronto Blue Jays' first season. So, you know, I've always had that connection too. And that's part of the reason why, as I went through my 77 Topps cards, and not including the star cards, when you're just looking at common cards, if you will, or semi-star cards, I have probably about 300 cards from 77. Amazingly, only 10 from the expansion teams, 6 from the Blue Jays, and 4 from the Mariners. And I can tell you, I know exactly why I have a few more from the Blue Jays, because I was a Blue Jays fan when I was growing up. And I remember as a teenager buying a couple of singles from binders of 77 Topps, simply because they were Blue Jays cards, and these were some of the guys that were on that first team, or at least were supposed to be. They were drafted by the Blue Jays, and they were, at least in the form of the set, representative of that first club, if you will. So taking David's suggestion that we look at these cards and look at the players and talk about the airbrushing, let's take a look back at the photography for Topps. As I've mentioned in previous episodes, Topps had a very simple structure for photography. You would have freelance photographers based mostly in New York City and in the San Francisco, Oakland, Bay Area. Sometimes they would use freelance photographers from the Chicago area, so occasionally you get that picture from Wrigley Field or Comiskey Park, but a lot of the pictures that you see from cards produced in the 1960s and 70s came from Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium, or if you want to go way back, the early 60s when the Polo Grounds was still being used. That's where most of them were taken, the late 50s sometimes. And then out west, once teams started going out west, you saw a lot of pictures taken in San Francisco, Oakland Coliseum, and that was pretty much it. So you got a lot of Giants and A's and Mets and Yankees in their home uniforms and a lot of everybody else in their road uniforms in those situations. And then you had the freelance photographers that were based in Florida or who would be assigned to Florida to go to spring training. So you had a lot of pictures with palm trees in the background. I should add, not just Florida, Arizona as well. So you would have palm trees in the background, or you would have the hills and mountains of Arizona that were often located right behind some of these spring training facilities. So that was your basic photography setup. A lot of freelancers in New York, San Francisco, and then in the spring training sites. So when pictures were taken of players in any of these settings, you had two types of pictures that were taken. One was the picture of the player, you know, taking a swing or throwing a ball, and you could see the player's full uniform in effect here. And then the other type of picture that was taken was one that was taken just in case they got traded. And there were two styles of that picture. One was the photographer would basically get down on his knee and kind of shoot up, so you would have the players basically chest up and you would see the underside of their hat. You couldn't see the front of the hat and you couldn't really see much of the uniform. It was basically just a headshot. And then the other type of picture was the picture with the player taking the hat off. So you had a lot of pictures. You know, you look back at, in particular, the 1969 Topps set where you had those four expansion teams. A lot of those early series cards of the Expos and Padres and Pilots and Royals featured guys showing off their buzz cuts. You know, Topps took the pictures of the guys with their hats off and utilized those. And you see the same thing in the early 60s expansions as well. So that was very common. And often before, when Topps had to take care of an expansion year, so 61, 62, and 69. You saw a lot of the pictures of the guys with their hats off. And then those rare times where you had a full uniform picture, Topps simply airbrushed a logo out. That was it. They would pick a picture that didn't really showcase the uniform too much, but the guy had a hat on, and let's say that the guy used to play for the Cardinals while he's just been drafted by the Mets, so they would just airbrush that Cardinal logo off the hat, and that's how they got around to it. Now, because those sets in the early, or throughout the 1960s, I should say, because there were multiple series in the sets, you would have a lot of the airbrushed expansion cards in the first two or three series, and then in the high number series, you would see some of those spring training pictures come out, and you would see the players who were drafted by these expansion teams or picked up from the expansion draft through spring training. They were wearing their full uniform. So you would be able to see, and in the 1969 set is the best example of this, you would see in the higher series sets an Expos player in an Expos uniform at spring training in West Palm Beach. You would see a Royals player in a Royals uniform. And it's pretty interesting comparison, taking a card of a player from an expansion team in, say, Series 5 of a set and comparing it to Series 1 of the set. Night and day difference here. You know, you had the Series 1 guy where basically just his past team was blotted out from its existence, where the guy later on in the series, you were able to get him in full uniform, full color, and it looks a lot more professional than just airbrushing a logo off. So that's how Topps handled the expansions of the 1960s. Well, in 1977, a completely different story. In 1974, Topps going to a one-series set, and they had, of course, got burned with that, with the proposed move of the Padres to Washington, the infamous Washington National League cards. So that was speed bump number one of going into a one-series set for Topps in 1974. But also, Topps was saving money. Remember, in the 1970s, very tough economic times throughout the decade here in America. And as we discussed in our show a few weeks back about the 75 Topps mini set, the mini set was created out of mostly concerns about the economy. Would fans buy a smaller version of our base set? And would they continue to invest in it so that perhaps we offer this as the base set in a few years? And Topps was exploring a lot of different options to deal with the economic times. So they're dealing with one series of cards. They're dealing with a thinner card stock. That's one of the problems with 77 Topps and future sets. Using that thinner card stock, so the condition of the cards, the corners and the edges frayed and dented up a little easier than they used to. Well, now they're looking at this going, how do we put together team sets for the Seattle and Toronto expansion teams on a budget? So basically, they took what they did in the 1960s and just took it a step further. Instead of having to airbrush on a logo or a uniform here and there to reflect a traded player, Topps basically had to create two teams of players from old stock photos and try to recreate the look and feel of the new Seattle Mariners and the new Toronto Blue Jays, which is very hard to do considering the team hadn't even taken the field yet. So it was a pretty daunting task here, having to go through the files, find that best picture, and then to the best of their ability, not just, you know, blew out, if you will, that's B-L-U-E, out, you know, the logos from the old teams, but to create a look and feel for the new teams. So Topps had to do that, and you can see that the Mariners cards are a little better off than the Blue Jays cards, and simply because the Mariners hats were a lot easier to replicate. It was all blue, you had the gold trident. It was relatively simple. Now, a trident's not that easy to draw or paint on, so you had some rather squiggly tridents somewhere. But the Blue Jay logo is very complex. First of all, you have the blue cap with a white front, and then you have the blue bird. You have the red baseball and leaf around it. A lot of moving parts with the Blue Jay logo, so that was very hard for Topps to replicate there. And then on top of that, let's take a sidestep away from Blue Jays and Mariners. The 1976 offseason was the first offseason with free agency, and you had quite a few players who opted not to extend their relationships with their current teams, and they became free agents. So Topps had to do airbrushing on even more cards, and some pretty prominent players as well, because they were either traded before they got to free agency, so Topps had to identify them with their new team, or if the player had signed as a free agent in, say, November or December of 1976, then Topps had to doctor up the cards to make them, you know, look, again, like they were part of the team. Reggie Jackson, the best example. Reggie Jackson was a member of the Baltimore Orioles in 1976. He's courted by a lot of teams in the winter of 1976. Signs with the Yankees in 1977. So Reggie Jackson's 77 Topps card, of course, features him with an airbrushed Yankee hat and the pinstripe uniform as well, and also a mustache, which as a member of the Yankees at the time, you couldn't have. So Don Baylor, another great example. The 77 Topps Don Baylor is one of the goofiest airbrushed cards because Baylor was a product of Baltimore Orioles farm system, moves on to California with the Angels. And much like the Blue Jay logo, the Angel logo was very hard to replicate. You can't exactly just pull out a brush and some, you know, bottles of paint and draw it perfectly. And especially because Baylor's head is askew just a little bit. Well, so is the hat. So you have this kind of crooked Angels ball cap with this crooked and rather large Angel logo on the Don Baylor card. So the poor Topps artists, they really had a rough winter of 76 trying to pull together all of these airbrushed cards. And as I said before, the airbrushing, you would see much worse in future sets where somebody at Topps occasionally went, well, let's not just airbrush the hat or airbrush the uniform, let's airbrush the whole damn thing. And you would see, especially in 78, the Greg Minton airbrushed card, or as I like to call it, the Velvet Elvis of baseball cards. That one stands out. Also, Mike Paxton. I remember this card as a kid. Mike Paxton was a pitcher for the Red Sox. And I remember even as a teenager looking at a 78 Topps card going, wait a minute, is this painted on? And sure enough, it's Mike Paxton's mugshot, but with a Boston Red Sox cap painted on. I was like, what is this? Somebody decided to basically issue out a portrait of Mike Paxton as opposed to trying to find a picture of him and just airbrushing the hat. So it would get a little out of hand later on in the decade, but it was really out of necessity for Topps in 77, not only with all the free agency movement, but also, as I mentioned, with the expansion teams. So Topps had to do this. This is a tough task. Topps had to do this in record time. Remember, this is the late 70s. While technology had improved quite a bit, not quite to the standards of today. You know, over 40 years ago, there were still, you know, a lot of slow moving parts to get something done. The expansion draft of 1977 teams was held on November 5th, 1976. That's right, November 5th, 1976, basically 4 months before the 77 Topps set was released. So Topps had to get everything right. And if you watch an expansion team form, not just in baseball, but any other sport, you know that the expansion draft is not the be-all, end-all. There's other movement. The team signs free agent players. The team trades some of those players who were drafted for other players, but Topps was going to have none of that. They basically took the expansion lists from that draft, went out through their archive, found the best photographs that they could find, and then airbrushed them all and put them out there. So even though the 77 Topps airbrushing, especially the expansion players, but also the free agent players or players who were just traded, even though some of them are laughably awful, you have to give it up to Topps and their art department for basically, I don't know what the exact number would be, but if you include the expansion players, the expansion coaches and managers, and the free agent or traded players, Topps had to airbrush probably 80 or 90 cards of a 660 card set. That's, you know, about 15% of the set had to be recreated, if you will, from older photographs, I should say. So Yeah, we look at it and go, well, that's kind of crude. Boy, this logo's kind of sideways. This one's all squishy. The color's not right on this one. But think of the pressure here, where in the time span of, you know, basically about 2 months before the set goes to press, all right, we have to identify the players who have changed teams. Okay, we have to go through the photo archives to find the right picture. Okay, now we have to go in here and touch up all of these pictures and then take it to press. That was a pretty brutal, in particular, November and December of 1976, where the Topps artists had to do all this. So hindsight being 2020 and realizing the technological limitations of the time. Again, it was advanced for the time, but compared to now, very primitive. My hat, airbrushed hat, I guess I should say, my airbrushed Toronto Blue Jay hat logo is off to you, Topps artist, for doing yeoman's task in a very difficult circumstance. So we look at him now and just go, wow, this is pretty terrible. Because with computer technology, I can take a picture of any baseball player. I can alter his cap. I can even put him in a throwback uniform. Hey, I can put Mike Trout in a Seattle Pilots uniform if I wanted to. And I can do it relatively quickly, probably in just a couple minutes with a few clicks of a mouse. Not so much back then. So considering, again, probably a good 10 to 15% of this base set had to be touched up, or in some cases totally created, to have as current of a set as possible when the set rolled out during spring training of 1977, I think is actually, you know, a pretty daunting challenge that Topps met to the best of their ability. Now, as for the airbrushed cards, like I said, I've got 10 of them here, 4 from the Mariners and 6 from the Blue Jays. Let's start with the Mariners, and I've got a card here of one of the longest-serving members of the Seattle Mariners. His name is Glenn Abbott, or every time that I would find a card of his, and I do have a couple others from, I think, the early 80s, I always just want to go, "Hey, Abbott!" A little Abbott and Costello there, if you're too young to recognize that. Glenn Abbott, a pitcher for the Mariners, he was drafted in the 76 expansion draft. And when I say he was one of the longest tenured members of the Mariners, it turns out he played for the Mariners longer than any other player from the opening day roster in 1977. He was the team's wins leader in 1977 and 1980. Winning a whopping 12 games. He played basketball and baseball in high school, drafted by the A's in June of 1969, signs as an 18-year-old, moves up first through the University of Central Arkansas. Back then it was called State College of Arkansas. But he plays for them, very quickly moves up through the A's system afterwards, and makes his big league debut as a 22-year-old. Now, he is with the A's from 1973 to 1976. He's part of a very unique moment, not only in A's history, but Major League history, as he was one of 4 pitchers to combine for a no-hitter. In fact, it was the first 4-pitcher combined no-hitter in Major League history. Happened on September 28th, 1975. Great little backstory to that. The starting pitcher in that game was Vida Blue, and Vida Blue was still very, very dominant in 1975. Well, after 5 innings, Blue gets pulled, and Abbott is the first pitcher to come in relief. And the fans in Oakland are booing Glenn Abbott because Vida Blue was pulled after, having 5 innings of no-hit ball. Well, thankfully for Blue and Abbott, Paul Lindblad and Raleigh Fingers would finish up the work for them as well, and the A's would get that 4-pitcher no-hitter. Now, he gets drafted by the Mariners in the 77 expansion draft, and at first you may think that this is a bad thing for a guy like Glenn Abbott, but for him, it was a good thing at first, because one of the coaches for the Mariners was Wes Stock, who was also the pitching coach in Oakland. So there was some familiarity. Abbott knew that while he was going to an expansion team that wasn't going to win a lot, at least he had somebody who he could lean on, and in fact, vice versa, could work the other way. But reality, hits pretty hard afterwards, where being on a world championship team, in fact, Abbott was with the A's, with the 73 and 74 teams, going from a world champion contending team in the Oakland A's in the mid-70s to this basement-dwelling, rather poorly run Seattle Mariners team, that was very hard for him. And he wasn't the only player. There were a lot of other veteran players on that 77 team who were going from relatively successful teams to just this absolute disaster right out of the gate. Now, he would continue his career despite some injuries that, in fact, eliminated his 1982 season. He not only had injuries, he had some very serious illnesses as well. Despite his Seattle career wrapping up in 1983, he did go on to play with Detroit for most of the 83 and 84 seasons. He was cut by the Tigers late in the 84 season, did not participate in the World Series against San Diego, but did get a ring and a portion of the winner's earnings. So that was very classy of the Tigers to do that. Now, Abbott is still very much involved in baseball. After his playing career wrapped up in the mid-80s, he moved on to coaching in the minor leagues and is the pitching coach in Syracuse, with the Syracuse Mets. So very good on him to keep on playing, and just a very interesting footnote for a guy who not only took part in that four-pitcher no-hitter back in 1975, but turned out to be the longest-tenured player in the Mariners history from the early days, you know, the one roster player from that opening day who stuck around with the team for as long as he did, despite having to deal with that serious illness and some injuries along the way. Now, one of the other cards that I have here is a very interesting player, Pete Broberg. And, you know, David Moody asked, well, how many of these players from the 77 top set that are shown in these expansion uniforms, how many actually play for the team? Well, Pete Broberg, this card, this picture of him with a Mariners hat on, this is the closest Pete Broberg would be a member of the Seattle Mariners. He was drafted in the 1977 expansion draft, but in April of 1977, traded to the Chicago Cubs for the ubiquitous player to be named later, a player who would turn out to be Jim Todd. So Pete Broberg's Seattle Mariners career amounts to this baseball card and spring training. That was it. Now, a little more background on Pete Broberg, because there's a lot of interesting stories about Broberg. His father, Gus Broberg, three-time All-American basketball standout for Dartmouth College in the late 1930s and early 1940s, also a World War II veteran, renowned in his hometown of West Palm Beach. So there's a little bit of a family background to Pete Broberg. Well, Pete Broberg also excels in sports from a very young age. He was drafted by the Washington Senators in 1971 and became just the fifth player in Major League history to go straight to the major leagues after being drafted. He never played a day of minor league ball before his Major League debut. And this would cause a little bit of dissension with the ball club. First of all, Ted Williams was a huge fan of Pete Broberg, really thought that he could throw a curveball. So once Teddy Ballgame said that this player has some upside, well, Bob Short, the owner of the Senators and later the Texas Rangers, would take Ted Williams for his word. Whatever Ted Williams said, that was gospel. So even though Pete Broberg would turn out to be a fairly average pitcher, there was this idea that, well, Teddy Ballgame anointed him as a good pitcher, so he's going to do well. And he did not do well. In fact, Broberg would admit in an interview that was done several years ago that he just wasn't ready. You know, he was a standout in college, but he just didn't have a chance against the major leaguers very early on. And it turns out that the manager following Ted Williams, that of course would be Whitey Herzog, really didn't like Pete Broberg. So you've got Broberg, who's coming out of Dartmouth. He's anointed by Ted Williams to be a, you know, a decent prospect for the team. In fact, Williams said that Broberg threw the ball as hard as Bob Feller. So, I mean, you know, now you got Ted Williams comparing the kid to Bob Feller, and that's just it. There's no way that Broberg is going to live up to those expectations. And, you know, if Broberg's a little cocky, you can understand why, because here's this star from college who's being feted by Ted Williams. I mean, come on. A great story about the headbutting between Herzog and Broberg comes from the book Seasons in Hell. I've talked about this book before, written by Mike Shropshire. This is a book that I bought at the Barnes & Noble bargain shelf 20 years ago, and I still have it. It is such a great book. I've mentioned it a few times before on this podcast. This is Mike Shropshire was the beat reporter for the Texas Rangers from 1973 to 75. Mostly 73 and 74. They started pulling him away from the beat in 75. But it details the rather clunky arrival of the Texas Rangers, Ted Williams not being interested in managing a bad team in the early 70s, a rather gregarious and jocular Whitey Herzog as the manager, Billy Martin coming in 1974, the Rangers actually toying with contention in 74, the absolute fiasco of a front office that they had. It's a great book if you can find it, and I'm sure because it is, you know, 20 plus years old, I'm sure you can find a good used copy of it somewhere. Seasons in Hell by Mike Shropshire. So as I mentioned, Herzog hated Broberg because of the Ted Williams anointing that he was the next Bob Feller. So according to Shropshire, Herzog had been trying to trade Broberg to Boston. And he figured, well, you know, he's got this Dartmouth background and the Red Sox need more pitching, so we can just move him there. So according to this book, Herzog was offered a pick of two young outfielders, Ben Ogilvy or, are you ready for this, Dwight Evans. Can you imagine Dwight Evans playing for the Texas Rangers? Think about it. That bam box of a ballpark back then, it was basically this expanded minor league ballpark, the Heat in Texas. You know, Evans was able to take advantage of the nooks and crannies and the short distances to right field in Fenway Park. But boy, he would have lifted many a baseball into the jet stream at the old Arlington Stadium. Wow. But the trades never happened because Bob Short, the owner, did not want to make the deal. Again, you know, he took whatever Ted Williams said to heart. So an incredible missed opportunity, because as it would turn out, you know, Broberg, like I said, was a very average pitcher, and the Rangers missed out on a chance to get a talented but, shall we say, eccentric outfielder in Ben Ogilvy or in Dwight Evans. Now, what happened to Broberg after his problems in Texas? He would go on to Milwaukee, like I said, picked up by the Mariners via the expansion draft, never played for them, though, went on to Chicago and later Oakland. He had, you know, a little tough luck basically playing for a lot of teams that didn't do very well. So, you know, that's something that kind of hung on him. But Broberg has been very successful ever since his playing career ended in the early 80s. He has been an attorney in Palm Beach County for a company called Co. Broberg and Austin. He's been an attorney for, I want to say, about 30 years now. And, you know, he does kind of look down on his career a little bit, going, yeah, I was with some bad teams. But he also recalls one particular great moment early on in his career. He hit his one and only home run with the Senators. It was at RFK Stadium against Boston. Hit the clock in right center field. So this is, of course, pre-DH day. So that's kind of neat there. And I also found from this article that was written a few years ago a very interesting note about Pete Broberg. Even though Whitey Herzog didn't like him, even though Ted Williams thought he was the next Bob Feller, even though he had a major league career that took him through some very bad teams, he finds a little bit of rest and relaxation in cultivating exotic palm trees. Yes, according to this article, he has 20 different varieties in his yard. His favorite is the Fiji palm, and he collects trees and has done extremely well as an attorney, mostly in bankruptcy cases, from what I read. Apparently, he used to do divorce proceedings and absolutely hated it. Can't blame him one bit. So Pete Broberg, even though he was an average pitcher, played for some very below average teams and didn't quite live up to the billings that Ted Williams set and didn't make good friends with Whitey Herzog over the years, doing quite fine, thank you very much, over the previous 30 years or so of his life in the law practice. Now, the next card involves a player who is very influential in our podcast, and he's been dead for almost 30 years. Talking about Larry Cox, who is also drafted by the Mariners in the expansion draft, formerly of the Minnesota Twins and a couple other teams I'll talk about in a moment. But Larry Cox was big in how we kind of charted the course with this podcast, because when I originally came up with the idea a few years ago, I thought, well, you know, we can pull out a random card, talk about the card and the player, and kind of, you know, in some cases, make fun of the card because, or the player, as the case may be. Because if you ever look through any random selection of cards, especially from the 70s and 80s, you have some goofy cards, you have some goofy names, you have some, you know, weird pictures, and, you know, it's easy to make fun of them. And Larry Cox, when we were doing episode number 2, which focused on 81 Fleer, I pulled that card out at random, and I always remember that card because it was a dark photograph. It seemed to be like a cold, rainy day in Boston. The Mariners were in town. The Mariners were not good. Larry Cox looked very sad. He had that big catching mitt kind of, you know, covering his genitals. You know, he looks emasculated, looks kind of sad, and I'm just like, wow, look at this sad guy, how pathetic is this? And then you read up on Larry Cox, and what really caught me was the incredibly tragic story of how he died. He passed away in 1990 while playing racquetball with his son. He was only 42 years old. He had a heart attack. And that just tore me apart reading it. I was just like, wow, this is actually really, really sad. And, you know, that kind of pulled me away from the, well, let's just make fun of these guys. And, you know, let's talk a little more about these particular players here. So if you want the full Larry Cox story, go back in our archives. Episode 2 from way back in the summer of 2016 covers 81 Fleer and the full Larry Cox story. But the short version is he was in the Phillies farm system. Had very, very brief amount of playing time in Philadelphia, later traded to Minnesota, and then is made exposed in the expansion draft. So he is picked up by the Mariners, plays with them for a few years, or plays with them for 1 year, I should say, goes to the Cubs, then goes back to the Mariners for a few years, then goes to the Texas Rangers, then goes back to the Cubs. So he was kind of bouncing around with some pretty bad teams at the time. When he was done as a player, in the early 1980s, he remained in the Cubs system. He was a minor league manager, the bullpen coach of the Cubs in 88 and 89, which would include the Cubs' surprise winning of the 89 Eastern Division. And then, as I mentioned, during that offseason, he passed away at the age of 42. Now, the last Mariners card features the coaching staff and manager Darryl Johnson. Now, Johnson is best known as the manager of the Boston Red Sox during the 1975 World Series run. He was a manager of the Red Sox for about 2.5 seasons. Give you a little more of his playing career. First, he signed with the St. Louis Browns as an amateur free agent in 1949, works his way up through the Brown system, and makes his debut in 1952. He was a backup catcher, played not only with the Browns in 1952, but also hopped around between the majors and minors, played in the major leagues with the White Sox, the Yankees, the Cardinals, the Phillies, and the Reds, also the Orioles. Now, he would become a minor league manager, starts in Baltimore system, wins the championship with Rochester in 1964, has success in Elmira a couple of years later, and starts coming up through the Boston Red Sox system, and eventually becomes the manager of the Red Sox in the 1974 season. Part of the crew of 1975, the Red Sox not quite as successful in 1976, so he gets released and gets blasted by his former players. Gee, that's never happened in Boston before, has it? Johnson, you know, is portrayed as a dummy. You know, he wasn't very smart, didn't make very smart moves, and there's a lot of moves or non-moves that occurred in the 1975 World Series that you could debate whether Johnson made the right move or didn't, or if Sparky Anderson outmanaged him, and that's what helped Cincinnati win that World Series. But the Mariners, looking for an established major league manager, of course, trying to cover up a lot of the mess from the 1969 Seattle Pilots. They want to find a guy that has had a proven winning record, not only in the major leagues, but also the minor leagues as well, somebody who could represent the team well. So they hire Johnson, and Johnson comes in and he says, you know, we're going to bring in high quality players, and not only good players, but good people. And of course, the Mariners just really are a mess. And he's fired midway through the 1980 season. He would become an interim manager in Texas in 1982. And eventually becomes a minor league coordinator in the Mets system for a very long time. Finally wins a World Series ring as a member of the Mets staff in 1986. He would be the bench coach for Dallas Green throughout the second half of the 1993 season, a debacle of a season there for the Mets. But he would basically, even after his managing days were done, prove to be a key asset primarily to the Mets organization for the following 15 or so years. Now, Johnson passed away in 2004 of leukemia at the age of 75. And as I mentioned, the manager cards from 1977, I actually like this approach to these cards where it's not just the manager, but you also have the coaching staff on there too. So it's a neat way for fans to not just see the manager, but kind of see more people who were involved in the running of the organization, including Wes Stock, who again was the pitching coach in Oakland and later in Seattle. Part of the reason why Glenn Abbott didn't mind being drafted by the Mariners in the 77 expansion draft. Now, moving on to the Blue Jay cards. One that stands out here is Bill Singer, or as he was known as, the Singer throwing machine. Yeah, that's what Vin Scully called him when he was with the Dodgers. Very successful pitcher with the Dodgers, an all-star in 1970. He appeared with the Dodgers from 1964 to 1972. Would battle injuries for much of the remainder of his career, but still put up a 20-game season, an all-star season in 1973 with the Angels. But again, dealing with those arm issues, had to bounce around from the Angels to the Rangers, later the Twins, and then the Blue Jays selected him in the expansion draft in 1977. By the way, correction, he was an all-star in 1969 with the Dodgers, not 1970. My bad there. Now, Bill Singer also has a couple of very interesting footnotes in baseball history. He is the first pitcher to be credited with an official save in Major League Baseball. The save statistic became an official statistic in 1969, so the Dodgers opened the season in Cincinnati. Don Drysdale, your starter, coming in relief is Bill Singer, and he's able to hold that lead, qualifies by the save parameters, and picks up the first save in Major League history, April 7th, 1969. And then it would be 8 years later that Bill Singer would star with the Toronto Blue Jays. Now, even though his Blue Jay career was cut short because of injuries, he will always be known as the opening day pitcher for the Blue Jays in their 9-5 win over the Chicago White Sox, a game that is better remembered, not necessarily for the Blue Jays winning, but because it was snowing the night before, and Exhibition Stadium was covered in snow and ice. They actually had to bring a Zamboni ice resurfacer from, I think, Maple Leaf Gardens, and they had to scrape down the turf at Exhibition Stadium so the game could even be played. As I mentioned, Singer had some issues with injuries, some control issues as well. Had a very brief stint with the Blue Jays in 1977. Didn't play for them in 78, was a member of the organization, and was released right after the 78 season. Now, he would end his playing career then, and he gets into managing, and he gets into not just managing on the field, you know, coaching, but also moving up the management ladder, where he would get in huge trouble. In 2003, he was a special assistant to Jim Duquette, who was the GM of the Mets at the time. He made some racially insensitive remarks to Dodger assistant general manager Kim Ng, where he mocked Ng's Chinese heritage. Now, Singer was fired. He later apologized and blamed the incident on the Atkins diet, and he was drunk at the time. Well, that's his story, and he's sticking to it. Now, he would very briefly work with the Arizona Diamondbacks in 2005, then got hired on by the Washington Nationals in 2007, and he was the coordinator of scouting operations, ironically, in Asia. But Bill Singer, better remembered as the first starting pitcher of the Toronto Blue Jays, and also the first major league pitcher to be credited with an official save in 1969. Now, another Blue Jays card that I have here, Jim Mason, looks like he's having a pretty good time here. Jim Mason was what you would call the defensive specialist. He was a middle infielder, primarily a shortstop, couldn't hit to save his life, but he was good enough in the field to justify a relatively lengthy career. He played in the big leagues from 1971 to 1979. He started his career with the Washington Senators, moved on with the team to Texas later on, and would eventually get picked up by the Yankees, where even though he was not known for his hitting prowess, he had a couple of really outstanding moments at the plate on his record. For one, he hit four doubles in a game, managed to do it against the Rangers in Texas in July of 1974. And then in the 1976 World Series, he had just one plate appearance, but he hit a home run off Pat Zachary. It would be Mason's only postseason appearance, and it would be the Yankees' only home run of the four-game sweep at the hands of the Cincinnati Reds. So even though he had these little flashes of brilliance, this is a guy who pretty much his career batting average hung around in the low 200s. And there were a lot of people that called Mason or his batting average. They were trying to establish a 200 batting average as what they called the Mason-Dixon line. And this is because Leo Dixon, a catcher and teammate of his, they were not very good hitters. So if you were hitting around Mason or Dixon, then you were a pretty poor hitter. Not quite as well known as the Mendoza line, of course, Mario Mendoza, who had a career average of 215. People think that 200 is the Mendoza line. And by the way, I heard somebody share the story on a TV broadcast recently. Mario Mendoza still absolutely hates being associated with the Mendoza line. So Mason was a very weak hitting shortstop, but was able to have just enough of a career to have a few flashes of brilliance at the plate and then, be good enough in the field to justify 9 years in the big leagues. Now, a fellow teammate of Mason with the Yankees in 1976, Otto Velez, also known as Otto the Swatto. This was your prototypical power hitter of the mid to late 70s. Not quite as dangerous as Dave Kingman or, say, Gorman Thomas, but Otto Velez was a guy who you knew when he went up to the plate, there was a really good chance, I'd say a 90% chance of one of two things happening. He'd either hit the ball 420 feet or he'd strike out. Unfortunately for Otto, he did more of the latter, so he had a fairly brief playing career. Still, much like Mason, he was able to get 11 years in the big leagues, or actually most of 11 years. He had a very short time with the Cleveland Indians at the end of his career. But anyways, he was part of the Yankee organization from 1973 to 76, while Jim Mason had some moments of brilliance in the 76 World Series. That was not the case for Velez, as he struck out often in the 76 series, was booed by Yankees fans, and what do you know, finds himself available in the expansion draft. So the Blue Jays pick him up, and Velez was the first opening day designated hitter in Toronto Blue Jay history. He went 2-for-4 in that 9-5 win over Chicago. He was also the American League Player of the Month for April of 1977, as he hit .442 in 21 games. Pretty good. He'd finished the season with a .256 average and 16 home runs, 62 RBI in 120 games. But that was pretty much the pinnacle there for Otto, just that first season in Toronto, as he did not hit as many homers moving forward, and he would have a little bit of a revival in 1980. He hit 20 home runs, but again, it was one of those situations where he either hit the ball very hard and very long, or he didn't even touch it because he was just taking his hacks at the plate. Now, he did have one incredible game in the 1980 season. May 4th, 1980, he hit four home runs and a doubleheader against the Indians. And this is a very unique four home run scenario here, where he was able to hit each possible home run in the doubleheader. So that is a solo home run, a two-run shot, a three-run shot, and also a grand slam. So his home run and RBI totals were the second highest on the team during that 1980 season. Now, as the Blue Jays start getting some more talented younger prospects moving up into the system, Velez became less and less of a key part in the team, had very little playing time, very little effect on the team in 1981 and 82. And as I said, had a very brief time with the Indians in 1983. In fact, playing in just 10 games before he retired. But Otto the Swatto still very well loved in Toronto because of that magnificent start in April of 1977, that particular doubleheader against the Indians in 1980 as well. Now, the next two cards, I remember picking these two cards out from binders when I was a kid because they were not only Blue Jays from their first season, but also because one player was still playing in the late 80s when I was doing this purchase, and another player was still very active in coaching. In fact, he is still an active coach in Major League. That player is Dave McKay. Canadian born, is the first base coach for the Arizona Diamondbacks, has been for a long time, but he did have some experience with the Blue Jays early on. First, starting with the Minnesota Twins, signs as a free agent in 1971, moves his way up through the organization, makes his debut late in the 1975 season, but is relegated pretty much to minor league play in 1976. So he is left unprotected in the expansion draft, is picked up by the Blue Jays. He was the starting third baseman in their first ever game on April 7th, 1977. He also had two hits in that win over Chicago. He would play 95 games with the Blue Jays that season, but hit only 197 and was starting to be moved around the infield, was not primarily a third baseman, also played second and short. In fact, he would become the Blue Jays' starting second baseman in 1978, played a career-high 145 games, batting average picked up quite a bit with a .238. He also had a 98.4% fielding percentage at second base. So things are looking good for Dave McKay. Well, unfortunately for him, his play would drop off severely in 1979. He ends up going back to Syracuse, which was the AAA club for the Blue Jays at the time. And he eventually gets released in the 1980 offseason, gets picked up by the Oakland Athletics, plays for them for, I think, three seasons here. Best season was in 1981, where he hits .263. Also had a very productive ALCS against the Yankees, very productive division series against the Kansas City Royals as well. But that was pretty much the pinnacle of his playing career, as he struggled in 82. Was moving down into the minor leagues in 1983 and then became a coach under Jackie Moore with the A's in 1984. Now, he also establishes a connection with Tony La Russa, which would be key because La Russa would make him a coach or keep him as a coach in Oakland. He would be part of the A's World Championship team in 1989, of course, the team that also went to the World Series but lost in 88 and 90. And wherever La Russa went, that's where Dave McKay would go, also with Dave Duncan, longtime pitching coach and friend of Tony La Russa. So when La Russa went on to the Cardinals, that is where McKay and Duncan went. And of course, McKay wins a couple other World Series in St. Louis in 2006 and 2011. And like I said, he is in Arizona still a first base coach. And of course, with La Russa's association with the Diamondbacks, that should come as no surprise. But I remember finding this card and thinking, hey, that's that coach for the A's. He used to play for the Blue Jays. And a very special honor, too, for a Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame member as well, and Dave McKay. Now, the other card that I bought back then, and this was primarily because this player was still playing, Andy Ashby. Now, Ashby was a member of the Cleveland Indians from 1973 to 1976, but he can't work his way up to being the number one catcher at the time. So the Indians trade Ashby along with Doug Howard to the Blue Jays on November 5th, 1976 for Al Fitzmaurice. So Topps made the right choice here. Okay, there's this trade here with Fitzmaurice going to Cleveland, so we're going to, you know, paint up the Ashby Indians card here. And Ashby would see quite a bit of time in 77 with the Blue Jays. He played 124 games. There was a lot of question, though, as to exactly how is he going to fit in, too, because you had Rick Cerrone and Phil Roof as the top two catchers in Toronto. Plus, you had Ernie Witt, who was also an expansion draft pick from Minnesota in the minor leagues. And it would turn out Witt would have a very long, productive career as a catcher for the Blue Jays. So how does Ashby fit into the situation? So even though he had a lot of playing time in 77 and played half the season in 1978, the Blue Jays decide to trade Ashby to the Houston Astros in November of 78 for J.J. Cannon, Pedro Hernandez, and Mark Lomagiello. Now, sports columnist Bob Elliott back in 2007 referred to this trade as the worst trade in Toronto Blue Jays history. Now, growing up a Blue Jay fan, I can promise you there were worse deals than this. If I really wanted to rack my brain, I could think of some really bad trades that the Blue Jays had done prior to 2007. But anyways, despite that, it was at the time not a good deal. The other three players that the Blue Jays acquired didn't really amount to much. And on top of that, Ashby would become a mainstay in Houston for a very, very long time. So he joins the Astros in the 1979 season, his second game with the team on April 7th. You see a common theme here with April 7th? You have Bill Singer getting the first save in Major League history. You have Bill Singer getting the win for the Blue Jays in their first game. And Dave McKay and Otto Velez are playing in that game. Well, Ashby, on April 7th, 1979, catches his first career no-hitter, Ken Forsch holding the Braves to no hits in a 6-0 win. And then Ashby would catch his second career no-hitter in 1981 with Nolan Ryan holding the Astros to no hits in September of 1981. That would be Nolan Ryan's fifth no-hitter of his career. Ashby would just become a mainstay of the Astros organization, not only your number one catcher throughout the 1980s, but then later he would become a broadcaster as well, and was broadcasting with the team up until just a few years ago. And of course, Andy Ashby also had the very good fortune of looking like the Marlboro Man. This is a guy that definitely looked like he belonged in Houston and perhaps on the side of a Big League Chew pouch of bubblegum. Now, another player here is Larry Anderson. Now, this is from the rookie card here. This is one of those four-player rookie cards, and Larry Anderson is one of the four players here. Now, this is Larry Anderson, not Larry Anderson. All right, that's very, very important to throw out there. Larry Anderson, not Larry Anderson. Landy Anderson, the second of the two, is the former pitcher turned Phillies broadcaster who had a pretty lengthy big league career. Larry Anderson, who was drafted by the Blue Jays in the expansion draft, is not one and the same. In fact, he had a very, very brief major league career, was pretty much relegated to the minors for much of his career, and there's not a whole lot else that is out there. Larry Anderson was drafted by the Brewers in the second round of the 1971 draft, then later picked up by the Blue Jays in the expansion draft. Much like Pete Broberg with the Mariners, Larry Anderson would never play for the Blue Jays. This airbrushed rookie card of his is the closest that Anderson would get to playing for Toronto, because in January of 77, the Blue Jays send Anderson to the White Sox to complete a trade that netted them catcher Phil Roof. In fact, Roof was acquired by the Blue Jays before the expansion draft happened. Well, in August of 77, he's traded from the White Sox to the Cubs. In August of 78, he's traded from the Cubs to the Phillies. In 1979, he's sent from the Phillies to the Astros. He's then loaned to the Braves by the Astros in July of 1979, and then bounces around from Atlanta to Baltimore to the Detroit organization, and that's pretty much it. So like I said, very much like Pete Broberg, this picture of Larry Anderson, this very tiny thumbnail picture of him, of his rookie card sharing the space with these three other pitchers here, this is the closest that Larry Anderson got to the major leagues. And again, not to be confused with Larry Anderson, the Phillies pitcher. Of course, later, Larry Anderson pitched for several teams, but is best known as a broadcaster for the Phillies for the past several years, even though his duties have been scaled back considerably. So there you have it. Some interesting stories about the airbrushed players. Interesting stories about the photography system of Topps in the 1960s and 70s and how expansion and free agency altered that. Like I said, starting in the late 70s, because of this, Topps would employ more photographers to the spring training games so that you have more updated pictures of players than trying to count on, you know, pictures of them from their games in New York or the San Francisco Bay Area. So you would see more and more palm trees and desert backgrounds in Topps playing cards for the next several years because they didn't want to have to go back into the archives from 4, 5, 6 years ago to airbrush these cards. But like I said earlier, even though when you look back at these airbrushed cards, whether it's from 1977 or a few years before or a few years after, it's very easy to look at them and go, wow, this is crude. This is old school. What were they doing? But in the instance of 1977, the work that the Topps art department had to do to not only create baseball cards for two teams that had yet to take the field, but also for a couple of dozen players who had become free agents or who had been traded prior to free agency, they're moving from team to team. Topps had a lot of work to do to turn around a 660-card set for printing and public release in the spring of 1977. And I think overall they did a good job, especially given the technology of the time, the quick turnaround, and the heavy influx of all of these changes. Remember, about 10 to 15% of the set Topps had to basically recreate because of free agency and expansion. Now, that still doesn't give Topps a pass for Greg Minton in 1978. I don't know what they were thinking, creating the Velvet Elvis of baseball cards. All right, that'll do it for Wax Ecstatic this week. Again, tune in 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, April the 26th. I think I said 28th earlier. My bad. Friday, April the 26th is going to be our next podcast. And you will have to tune in then to see what we are talking about. If we're opening up some cards, if we're doing another discovery of a certain brand, or perhaps like David Moody, we're taking a suggestion from a listener and running with it in the program. So again, that is Friday, April the 26th. Not the 28th, 26th. We will go ahead and do that, and you can listen in on your regular method of listening, be it Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, also Spotify and Google Play and all the other groups that grab the RSS feed and send it your way. And please don't forget, if you got a few extra bucks left over, maybe you got a little bit of a tax refund, you are more than welcome to share the wealth a little bit, or I'll share that 89 Bowman Rack Pack with you. Make a cash donation to paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.